Hello, this is Elazar Weissman, senior editor of the Georgetown Public Policy Review podcast. In this episode, I speak with Randy Irwin, the president of the National Federation of Federal Employees, a union representing thousands of federal workers across the nation. In addition to being a Georgetown alum, Mr. Irwin possesses unique insights into the current situation and obstacles faced by federal employees, most notably wildland firefighters. In this interview, we discuss some of these challenges as well as strategies for bringing about a brighter future. I hope you enjoy the following podcast. All right. Well, again, it's really nice to meet you in person. I wanted to get started by asking you to talk a little bit about your career, how you got started, and yeah, if you could just start with that.
Okay. Well, I'll first say who I am. I'm Randy Irwin. I'm the national president of the National Federation of Federal Employees. We're a union that represents 110,000 federal workers nationwide. We got workers about 50,000 at defense, about 20,000 at the U.S. Forest Service. We got the nurses, doctors, and healthcare professionals at 50 VA hospitals and outpatient clinics across the country, and about 35 other federal agencies across government. So how did I get here? I never thought that I would be doing what I'm doing. I went to Georgetown University as an undergraduate, and I went to the business school, McDonough School of Business, and graduated with a degree in marketing and management. And I was going to be a consultant. So I thought that's what I'd be doing. And my senior year, I had a big job lined up with PricewaterhouseCoopers, at that time considered a pretty good job right out of school to be a consultant. And a week before my start date, I got laid off. And so I had the job lined up for 8 months. And then I kind of got the rug pulled out from under me. My wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, was going into her senior year at Georgetown. She was at the School of Foreign Service and, you know, just about to start her senior year when that happened. And she said, I was from Miami, Florida. She said, just get back up here. Just get back up to DC. You have friends. You can crash on couches until you find something. And, you know, because I didn't have a way to even to get an apartment or anything like that. Yeah. And in my industry, consulting, which I thought was going to be my industry, nobody was hiring either. You know, the tech bubble had burst. And so there weren't a lot of opportunities at that time. So I went to temporary agencies. And I said, give me the best temporary to permanent job you have out there. And I got an opportunity to come to the National Federation of Federal Employees. And I came in there. My interview was September 11th, 2001.
Oh, wow.
That was the day of my interview. That interview got canceled. But a few days later, I interviewed and I started on the 21st of September that year. And I was a temp answering the phones. You know, when you call NEPI headquarters, you know, I would answer the phones. And then 3 years later, or 3 months later, I became the assistant to the national president. It was his assistant that had moved on and why they needed a temporary worker in the first place. But I was just kind of in the right place at the right time. And I didn't hardly know what a union was, when I came to NEPI. I didn't know much about the federal government for that matter. You know, we're a government union that represents the government workers. But I didn't want a permanent job very bad. So I get an apartment and establish myself. And so that's how I got started. And then from there, I just kind of took advantage of my opportunities. I kind of felt like I was at the right place at the right time. I benefited from some really tremendous mentors who kind of saw some potential in me and helped me. About two and a half, 3 years in, I became NEPI's legislative director and chief advocate on Capitol Hill and the public spokesperson of the union. So I was kind of very much public facing and trying to, you know, to advocate for our members in any way possible. And so I kind of cut my teeth and built my reputation in that role. But anyway, from the day I walked in as a temporary worker, 15 years later, almost exactly, I became national president of the union.
Oh, wow.
And so it was a great little ride. But I'm real honored and blessed to be doing what I'm doing.
How was it for you to adjust to some of those new responsibilities? Like, what were some of the highlights?
Career highlights, kind of.
Yeah, career
Yeah.
highlights, yeah.
Well, so if a few of them stand out. I would say one of the very biggest is getting a pay increase for wildland firefighters. So this was just a couple years ago. There was a bipartisan infrastructure package that worked its way through Congress. It was signed by President Biden, and in it, they, wildland firefighters have been woefully underpaid for a long time. And if you know the GS system, they're mostly GS3s, fours, and fives, which is very low on the federal pay scale. They were starting at $13 and change, when in a lot of places where they work, in California, for example, the minimum wage was higher than $13 and change. So, I mean, it was for the kind of work that wildland firefighters do, they're being paid peanuts and not a living wage. So that was a major problem. But in this infrastructure package, we got for federal wildland firefighters nationwide, we got an increase of 50% up to $20,000 per year. So for most wildland firefighters, they got a $20,000 pay bump, and it was much needed and life changing for them. And so, that was only for 2 years. Since then, for the last like 3 4 months, we've gotten that pay increase extended, into this fiscal year. We're finally into the kind of the next fiscal year after it expired. But it's a thing where we think Congress is going to kind of keep that going. We're optimistic that they will eventually make that permanent. We think that that's an easy, right policy decision to make, and there's a few hurdles that we have to get over to make it happen. But we really do need to make that happen. But getting that done the first time was really a huge thing. It was life altering, and for anybody who was impacted by that, and it was a real nice win.
Yeah.
We were able to get this thing called the National Security Personnel System repealed. This was a big thing that was going on. During the Bush administration and into the Obama administration, where back after 9/11 in 2002, they were kind of using 9/11 as a pretense to take away collective bargaining in the federal sector. And first they did it when they created the Department of Homeland Security. They established it and took away collective bargaining rights for the most part. And then they went to Congress and said, "Oh, this is working great. We should do the same at Department of Defense." Well, Department of Defense is about a third of the federal workforce, about 600,000 civilian federal workers there. And they passed legislation in 2002 to do away with collective bargaining rights in the Department of Defense, with the plan in mind to make it government-wide shortly after. So that was really kind of an existential fight for the existence of federal employee unions. And and we had to fight and win that. I mean, if we lost the ability to bargain and defend workers in the federal sector, it would really hurt the workers themselves, who we represent. But it would also fundamentally alter the way our government works for the American people. As it is, there's this never-ending desire to starve the beast and squeeze federal workers. For example, they make 26.5% less than private sector workers doing the exact same jobs. So there's this kind of constant pressure, and squeezing federal workers. We saw it, nobody hurt worse than wildland firefighters, but it happens throughout the federal government. And so if we went away, they'd never see another pay increase again. Their pay would be frozen, and the quality of government service would go down and down and down. And federal workers are doing such important work for the American people, caring for our veterans, keeping our military ready, keeping our air and water safe, protecting our borders, protecting our national security. So the work they do, everybody loves the work that individual federal employees do for the most part. They like those missions. And that's why those missions, Congress has never had an appetite. And all the cuts that have occurred, they're not saying we're going to get out of the business of this or that. They never do that. But they do kind of squeeze the existing workforce in various ways, try to whittle away at pensions, try to give them a pay increase that doesn't keep pace with inflation, and over time turns into just a worse and worse job where you can no longer recruit and retain the best and brightest and what the American people deserve. So, being able to kind of in 2020, in 2002, they passed NSPS to take away collective bargaining rights. It took us all the way to 2010 to repeal that and have collective bargaining rights restored. And now, you never know what threats are going to come down the line. But for now, federal workers have collective bargaining rights and they're not currently under threat.
That's incredible.
Yeah. A couple other things is, in the last couple years, our union has experienced 25% net growth. So, for us, membership is our bread and butter. It's the lifeblood of the union. It's what makes everything that we do for our members possible. And 25% is a number that we're very, very proud about.
Yeah.
So that's something that I'm proud of. And so is everybody else here at NEFI.
Absolutely. So you spoke a little bit about your career trajectory and how you didn't really anticipate on joining a union.
Sure.
You didn't know even, was really, and then now you're leading one of the largest ones in the country, and but so I want to move on to what you think, and you mentioned the wildland firefighter issue as well, but I was curious if you believe that is the current biggest issue that needs to be solved, or what other sort of labor issues you view right now as priorities for federal workers.
Where you sit is where you stand.
Okay.
We have a lot of wildland firefighters, and that's a major issue for us.
Right.
I do think that it's significant nationally because it's one of these areas where people don't realize how bad the problem has got. They don't really realize it until there's a huge fire that's not being put out, and there's smoke everywhere, and bad news is all over the news.
Right.
But unlike every place else in government, you can't do business as usual in the Forest Service because the problem has grown exponentially with climate change, or let's say at least correlates with climate change, right? Right. I'm not trying to overstate it here, but right. And so fire seasons have gotten much longer. They've gotten much more intense. The problem is just bigger. But when you kind of have this kind of kick the can down the road kind of approach, which Congress has had with not passing appropriations, but continuing resolutions and those sorts of things, in other agencies, it's not the end of the world sometimes. It's kind of like, okay, a little nibble here is manageable. In the Forest Service, when the problem is going up exponentially, the problem, you cannot respond that way. And so that's what we've had. We've had a couple decades of the problem, jumping off the page, in how bad things have gotten with no corresponding response from Congress, our policymakers. And so we don't have nearly enough money in the budget. We don't have nearly enough boots on the ground. Those that are many have already reached their breaking point and left, folks that are those boots on the ground, wildland firefighters. Everybody left is teetering, or the majority of them are, and they're just continuing to get squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. And so we really need some kind of new deal for how we handle wildfire in this country. But it really all starts with paying the wildland firefighters better. The very first thing we need to do is pass legislation to this Wildland Firefighter Paycheck Protection Act. It's a piece of legislation that we've been pushing, and it would make that 50% or $20,000 pay increase permanent, and take away the kind of insecurity that most federal wildland firefighters have. We were up lobbying on Capitol Hill. We flew a bunch of our wildland firefighters into town last year, and there was one who was on a hotshot crew, which is an elite group of wildland firefighters, kind of like Navy SEALs of wildland firefighters. So not just your average, but the best. And a typical hotshot crew has 20 members of it. And, she reported to Capitol Hill and to the White House and other places that on her hotshot crew, of the 20, there were 12 that, because of their financial situation, were living in their cars. And that we cannot, that is not right. That is not humane. It's not fair by a mile. And we just got to do better in this country. And we can't expect to be able to contain wildfire. In the end,
if we don't have wholesale change, people will stop working for the federal government, for the Forest Service. We won't have the boots on the ground to contain wildfire. Communities are going to burn and people are going to die. And people have to understand that those really are the stakes. And we're getting there, but we're not quite there yet.
No, I think you summed that up really well. It was incredible. I guess, so in the interest of like making progress, it requires a bipartisan support a lot of times to get these sort of bills passed and these policy decisions made. How do you manage these bipartisan relationships? How do you manage advocating for wildland firefighters within this like very polarized, complex system?
Well, you know, I'm proud of the lane that we've carved out, because it's hard to do and there aren't many people who benefit from this. But, you know, we have kind of, we believe we're the most bipartisan union in America. And we do work equally with both Republicans and Democrats. And that can be hard to do sometimes. But you know, we've done it by, one, never crossing any member of Congress off the list in terms of who are we going to continue to try to build relationships with, and you know, continue to try to drag in your direction to kind of see the light on what federal employees are doing. And so, you know, we've done that over time. And even if you can't say, let's say, you know, right now we're pushing for, I talked about federal employees pay 26%, 26.5% less than what people doing the same jobs in the private sector are making. That's unsustainable. We got to do better than that. We got legislation called the Fair Act to get 7.2% raised this year. That would put a little dent in that pay gap, not a lot, but kind of, you know, close that gap just a little bit. That's a legislation that we're, you know, have been kind of lucky to get any, say, Republican co-sponsors on that legislation. We got one last year. We were very happy to get one, you know, and I was like, hey, that's a bipartisan legislation, right? But so even if you know, we've got members that live in a Republican congressional district, even if you can't get them on that, at least get them to care about the issue of the federal employees that they actually have in their district. So if it's a defense base they have, okay, get them up, find some common ground there. If you got a forest or a park or whatever it is, get them to understand and see the benefit and the value of the work that their constituents are doing as federal employees, because it's very easy to just broad brush it and go, oh, you know, federal employees are all lazy bureaucrats in Washington. Well, that's not really the case. You got 85% of federal workers are not in the DC area. They're spread out throughout the country and they're doing very, very valuable work for the American people exclusively. And so when you see a member of Congress, they go, oh, well, I don't really like all this, these bureaucrats or whatever, but I like my federal employees. Almost every single one of them will say that, you know, the ones in my district are fine. Well, everybody's saying that. Okay. You know, So in order to have these bipartisan things, you got to cross nobody off the list. And the other thing is you got to call balls and strikes fairly and consistently. And, you know, that is hard to do when politics is inserting itself. So you really got to do all you can to kind of get above politics and really focus on advocacy and policy and legislation. But then, you know, calling balls and strikes fairly, and I'll give you a good story. Mitch McConnell, you know, from Kentucky, he was the Senate minority leader now, but was the majority. Well, a few years ago, there was a big government shutdown. Lasted 35 days. Our members were, you know, had missed two paychecks and were getting to a point where they were really starting to feel the pain of this extended government shutdown. And we had kind of, there had been legislation that would pass out of the House to end the government shutdown. And there was something about like 80 senators had indicated that if the House version came to the Senate floor, that they would vote for it. So they would vote to end the shutdown. And Mitch McConnell would not bring, for a period of time, was refusing to bring that to the floor. Well, we, you know, were very hard on Mitch McConnell in that era. You know, where we sit is where we stand. And even though we've had a relationship with Mitch McConnell, in this instance, he is not bringing this to the floor and our people are starving and you know, he's at the center of that.
Yeah.
I was on CNN four times, you know, screaming from the rafters that we need Mitch McConnell to bring that to the floor to end the shutdown. Eventually, the shutdown ended. Okay, and about 3 months later, there was the pre President Trump, his administration announced that they were gonna shut down the civilian conservation centers, which is a part of the Forest Service. What they do is they train at-risk youth in trades. It's a very valuable thing, a very good return on America on taxpayer dollars. It's a great thing, a great program. And they were just going to shut down the federal civilian conservation centers that do this work. It was our members that do that training. And we had 1,200 members who were going to lose their jobs. There were about 28, 29 facilities across the country that were going to close. We had worked with Mitch McConnell for years in protecting this program. He was the only state that had three civilian conservation centers in his state. So we went to Mitch. We said, "Hey, Mitch, I'm paraphrasing here, but sorry about the all the things with the shutdown. We know how it goes. Where you sit is where you stand. But we have been working for you a lot with you for a long time on the civilian conservation center issue. Your state is more impacted than any other, and we really need a letter to President Trump to say, hey, what are you doing? Like, abandon this idea." He wrote that letter, and after that, I went out there and was praising Mitch McConnell for taking that action. And I took a lot of heat, and that's calling balls and strikes fairly. Where some they would kind of get to that step and not go praise Mitch McConnell, because whatever, for a labor person saying, "Hey, this guy doesn't have a great labor record." Well, he did the right thing in this place, in this instance, And so I said, so I went out there and praised him and said, "Hey, thank you for standing for the civilian conservation workers in Kentucky." And if you don't do that, why would any member of Congress do anything for you ever again? And if you want to really have bipartisan alliances, and anything meaningful that you ever want to get done has got to be bipartisan. If you're only working with one side of the aisle, you're only going to get crumbs. If you can get something done with both sides, you can actually get something done meaningful. And so that's been our approach, and it's worked for us.
Oh, that was really great. So moving forward, can you and you sort of just actually kind of beat me to the punch with giving a great example of a bipartisan approach. But I guess my next step is, you've talked about your career, you've talked about the issues in the field, and you've talked about some strategies that you've utilized for overcoming some division in the country. I guess my next question would be, what advice you have for, current students, maybe graduate students, people who are entering the workforce for moving forward and getting involved in maybe union work or the public policy field of labor relations.
So I think the first thing is to really find what it is you care about and do whatever it takes to be doing that full time. Get your foot in the door. You want to work for labor unions, get a full-time job with a labor union, and then find a way to make a difference once you're there. Or sometimes you have to parlay in your career. Sometimes it's not, for me, I started working at an EFI, and this is literally the only job since I've had out of college. I've had different roles, but I've been working for the same place. So that's, I'm blessed and lucky for that. But you gotta get your foot in the door and be working full time. Then it's important to really understand your industry and be looking for the ways. I mean, look for the gaps that aren't filled. Find a niche that might work for you, that you avoid, that you can fill and have a niche and add value, and understand what out there on a macro level. Like, where is this industry going? What aren't people seeing? Understand your industry and understand how to add value, and then you just have to get after it. I mean, it's work ethic. It's definitely relationships. Building relationships, that again, bipartisan relationships. Don't just sing to the choir and make friends with people who are already friends. You gotta get bipartisan. You gotta get a diversity of friends. And then another major thing is be willing to accept half a loaf, because that is how change is incremental. It does not happen wholesale very often. And so you get half a loaf, and then you go for another half a loaf, and you go for another and another and another and another. And when you add it up at the end of it, you're like, wow,
we've really made some progress here. But it very rarely happens in one fell swoop. So you got to take it bit by bit and make change over time incrementally.
Okay. Yeah, that's great advice. And just to close, and I know we've moved sort of fast through your career and through all the policy areas, but I guess I would want to give you like a little bit of space to talk about what you hope to see happen in the future. And
Well, it just really irks me the way people talk about federal workers across the board. They're doing such tremendous work for the American people every day, but they're not shown that respect. That was not always the case. A couple decades ago, Republican or Democratic administration showed respect for the federal workforce, career civil servants that are doing great work. And that has to change back. I mean, first of all, they're kind of perpetuating myths in order to kind of paint federal workers in a bad light. That is a little bit tied into, trying to trim budgets and things like that. Who knows why they're doing it, but it has to stop. And I think the only way to do that is to kind of for federal workers themselves through their unions, because there's no other groups out there. There's a few federal employee unions like NEFI, but if they got to stand up through their unions and command their respect. Nobody's given respect. You got to take respect. You got to command it. And the thing is, they've got truth on their side, federal workers do. And so, we need to stop the bashing. We need to earn our respect back by standing up to our unions and demanding it from the American public, from our leaders. But we need a critical mass. I mean, that's to change people's perceptions is a hard thing to do. It takes a multi-decade plan and execution and messaging and kind of, one problem is a lot of organizations are bureaucracies. And the bureaucracies are when they're shrinking, like a lot of unions are getting smaller, they don't have enough money to do the things they want to do or know the things that they need to do long term. They're just trying to keep the lights on and keep people from getting laid off, and you're being short term in your thinking and the things that you should be doing. Well, we need to change that. And so if we can get back on the upswing, be growing our organizations and being strategic about how we're spending our money and how we educate the public about the work we do in the federal government and the role that unions play, then we can change the way people think. But until we start moving in that direction, and I think we're starting to, but we got a long way to go. And that's what I want to see change. I want federal workers to be respected and people not have the dis inherent mistrust of government that doesn't make sense. It's kind of they're not it is an irrational fear of government. Not that people shouldn't be skeptical of government or be critical of the role that government has to play. Those are fine. But the things that are irrational based on fallacy, mistrust of federal workers just because they are a federal worker, that stuff doesn't make any sense and needs to change. So I like to see that's the direction I like to see things go.
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, I really appreciate you setting aside the time today to speak with me. And it's been a great conversation. So thank you again.
Appreciate the
Yeah,
opportunity. Thank you, my
appreciate it.
friend.
Thanks for being here.
All right.
Enjoyed this episode from the Georgetown Public Policy Review podcast. If you're interested in catching up on some of our old episodes or want to stay tuned in for future ones, please subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or SoundCloud. Also, feel free to check us out on our website at gppreview.com. Thanks again, and see you next time.